You are Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast on the Houston Rockets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to another new episode of Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast commentary on all things Houston Rockets basketball. As always, I'm your host, Ben Dubose, Rockets correspondent with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship in Houston. On today's show, on Tuesday, October 30th, to get a little bit of national perspective on the Rockets and this very disappointing 1-4 start to the season, I'm joined by Matt Moore, senior NBA writer for the Action Network and better known as HP Basketball of Twitter fame. Matt, how's it going, my friend?
Going well, man. How are you?
Doing well. Would be doing a lot better if the Rockets weren't 1-4, but is what it is. Anyway, full disclaimer before we get too deep into the podcast, we're recording this late afternoon Tuesday just before the Rockets play the Blazers tonight. So by the time you're listening, it's entirely possible the Rockets might be 1-5 or hopefully 2-4. But really, barring any sort of additional major injury on top of James Harden already being out with the hamstring strain, I don't think any of the major themes are going to change. Whether they're 1-5 or 2-4, it's still a very disappointing start and a hole they're going to need to climb out of during this upcoming 5-game road trip starting Friday in Brooklyn. Anyway, Matt, before we get to the serious stuff, I'll start you with a softball. We're both University of Missouri grads, and I know you've still got a few other ties to that part of the country, most notably the now 7-1 Kansas City Chiefs. Are you fully on board the Pat Mahomes Super Bowl train, or are you still expecting the other shoe to drop once there's a home playoff game at Arrowhead in January?
Can I be both? I think Patrick Mahomes is going to make the Super Bowl, but only him. The Chiefs can't make it. So Patrick Mahomes will be playing by himself versus the New Orleans Saints or Los Angeles Rams in the Super Bowl. That I feel pretty comfortable about. The Chiefs will definitely not make it. No, you know, honestly, Mahomes is so good that I've actually started talking about getting a Mahomes tattoo. and I'm like only like 30-40% kidding on that. I had an executive offer to pay for the tattoo if his team made the conference finals, which I'm still debating about that. It's a good time. I'm pretty excited about it for it. Looking forward very much to the Houston Texans taking on the Denver Broncos, who I love watching lose. I live in Denver, and so I love, as a Chiefs fan living in Denver, I love watching the Broncos lose. And very excited for Demaryius Thomas to help the Texans absolutely beat the snot out of a terrible Broncos team.
There you go. And I'll throw in a plug for our Locked On Texans sister show, which will have a show later tonight breaking down the Demaryius Thomas trade from the Broncos to the Texans. And yeah, I go back and forth about playing the Chiefs in the playoffs. On the one hand, I want the Texans to play the Chiefs because it seems every January there's some sort of incomprehensible, catastrophic loss at Arrowhead Stadium for the home team. The flip side is that they look so ridiculously good now with Pat Mahomes that I have a tough time seeing it happen again. I know history is what it is, and if I were in your shoes, I mean, we're both in the University of Missouri shoes, so, you know, I know what it is to think that, you know, your team isn't going to be able to pull it off, but Pat Mahomes, he's something else. Anyway, as far as the Rockets go, I want to lead off by giving you an opportunity to kind of issue a position statement, if you will. And, you know, they're starting 1-4. If you'd have told me even a couple of months ago that the Chiefs would have better odds in 2019 of winning a title than the Rockets, I would have thought you're crazy. But right now, that may be where we are. At the very least, you can make an argument for it. But as far as the Rockets, a lot of it obviously traces back to the offseason. And some of you listening may have already know this if you follow Matt and I on Twitter at HP Basketball and at Ben Dubose. But for anyone that hasn't seen our back and forths, I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of explain the reservations you've had for a while about this particular Rockets team. And before you answer that, let me throw out one more disclaimer to our listeners. I know the current 1-4 record, for those of you that are diehard fans, I know it's got a lot to do with injuries and suspensions, particularly those to James Harden and Chris Paul. It's also a really small sample. I understand all of those. I'm not overlooking it. That said, when you go from a 65-win juggernaut that was probably a hamstring away from the title to now starting 1-4, any changes are going to be under the microscope, fair or unfair. That's just how it is. From my perspective, as far as what's different about the Rockets this year and the validity of some of the national narratives, look, I think we can all agree that in early July, when the Rockets lost Trevor Ariza and Luke Bamute, two good defensive wings, and only added Michael Carter-Williams, that was a blow. There's no other way to spin it. It was a bad start to free agency. From there, at least, they added James Ennis, they signed Carmelo Anthony, they traded Ryan Anderson for Brandon Knight and Marquise Chris. Melo said all the right things, even about coming off the bench. They all raved about their offseason workouts in the Bahamas. They looked great in the preseason. Mike D'Antoni went out of his way several times to say he thought it was a better team this year than last year. And yet, Matt, I wouldn't say that you buried them, but you were definitely cautious. Even when the over-unders came out in September, I think Houston was somewhere around 56 wins. That's 9 fewer than a year ago. You were still saying stay away. So if you could, just kind of give people the background of why you never really changed that much off of your initial position of, I would say, somewhat skepticism entering this season.
Okay, so let's start here on things we can agree with. One, it's early. We can agree, two, that the Rockets are not going to be the team that they are now in March. Mm-hmm. I talk about this a lot, about how teams essentially go through 2 to 3 different iterations of themselves throughout the course of a season. So they will go from, the Rockets will not be the same team that they are now later in the year. They will be a different team in January, and they will be a different team in March. They could be back to a 65-win juggernaut. They could be better. They could be worse. They could be slightly worse. They could be way worse. It could be an implosion. There's all these things we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I need very much for it to be known, I did not come on this podcast to do a I told you so tour,
right?
Because no one in their right mind would take their do an I told you so off of this few games. Like, we are not even into, you know, I do think these day games matter. Like, these games, especially a lot of these Western Conference losses, could wind up hurting later in terms of tiebreakers. I advocate for that. Like, you know, these games matter too. But there's a lot of stuff left to do. So I initially, the gut reaction when I looked at their offseason, and I was asked about, like, when I started thinking about, like, what number am I going to put them at as an instinctive? My first number was 54. And Rockets fans initially were like, that's insane. That's 11 fewer than we won last year. There's no way they dropped that much, et cetera. Part of it is I have a different kind of perspective on the regular season. I would call it an understanding, just because I watch 30 teams as intently as I can,
sure,
throughout the entire course of the season. And so I see trends that happen over and over and over again versus team fans tend to see what has happened with their team over and over and over again. But those teams generally tend to change very much. Like, the Mike D'Antoni teams are not the McHale teams, which are not the JVG teams. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just not the same organisms. And one thing I do know is that once you get above 60, you're in such a gravy zone that you can kind of, it's a bell curve where the difference between a 21-win team and a 15-win team is not really all that different. And honestly, the difference between, like, a 25-win team and a 15-win team, those teams are not radically different.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between a 57-win team and a 65-win team, not that radically different. You can pile up these wins when momentum is going your way, and that will carry you through some times where you probably should lose. And the momentum, like, everything goes your way. Last year, everything went Houston's way right up until Luke got hurt and Chris got hurt. That's everything went their way until that freaking hamstring. I bought into that team last year. I talked a lot about that team last year. People will point to how I said the Warriors would sweep them in that Western Conference final series. The reason I did that was because, like, every time I look at the Warriors, I'm just like, God, how do you beat this team?
Right.
And I assumed the games would be close and that the Warriors would win, and it would cause, like, a real down sense of, oh, we can't do this, and then that would be it. And the fact that the Rockets battled back, they proved so much to me. I was so, honestly, like, just, I was so impressed with that team last year. But that's that team. It's that combination. And while the core element of Capella, Harden, Paul, which is what you guys love to cite the records about,
sure,
is phenomenal, to win in the margins, to win those little games, to get to a record like 65, to be as good as you were last year, you disrupted that chemistry in building this year's team. You took something that I knew worked, and you changed it. And not only did you change it, but you changed it with pieces that I looked at and go, well, that doesn't work the same way. Even if that works, which I don't know if it will, it doesn't work the same way. And so that was the reason for my skepticism. Now, after a lot of feedback, I pushed almost immediately up to 57 wins.
Sure.
I jumped all the way back up to 57 wins almost immediately when those numbers came out in, like, July. But what happened, I think it was September, but what happened was when Jeff Bezelic left, that's when I was like, ooh, I don't know. Let's rattle this back a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so I dropped them down one loss back down to 56, which is right at their over-under. And that was the thing, is if you told me that the Rockets won 65 this year, I would have been like, all right, makes sense. They're a really great team. Capella, Harden, and Paul win a lot of games together. Mike D'Antoni's a great coach. There you go. PJ Tucker helps a lot. not, you know, that makes sense. But if you told me that the Rockets only won 50 this year, I also wouldn't be surprised. I'd be like, well, you added Carmelo Anthony and Michael Carter-Williams. Chris Paul has a history of injury issues. Harden's had an unbelievable load on himself, and they lost their defensive coordinator. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. They're not going to be bad. I think they'll get the ship righted. But I do think that I didn't mind the pushback. I don't mind if you're like, I think they could still be really good. I still think they could be good. The fact that Rockets fans were always so just, like, indignant, like, how could you possibly think that Trevor Ariza was this MVP-type player? I never really got to explain it because there just wasn't time, and I didn't have it in me to really write a column about it. I wrote some stuff, but the real thing is that special combination of players had something that created that kind of team. This combination of players, I don't know what they're going to create. So far, they have not created anything good.
I'll get you to expand a little bit more on the Ariza angle, because I know your like least favorite thing in the world is that 14-0 stat that everyone brings up, right? Because I think they were 14-1 in games that Ariza missed last year, and the one was the season finale in Sacramento, which they tanked, no one played. So a lot of people refer to that as 14-0, but I know you view that as underselling his impact, and I think we can agree, like, my biggest pet peeve, Matt, with a lot of the national takes is that after the Western Conference Finals, there were some national takes that effectively, and I think a lot of it traces back to no one expected the Rockets to be as close as they were a year ago. There were some takes after the Western Conference Finals citing that, well, the Rockets' window was shutting, that they had missed their chance in large part because of the ages of the supporting cast, guys in their 30s like Trevor Ariza, like Luke Bamute, like PJ Tucker, and now all of a sudden that a couple of those guys are out and they've largely gone younger, Carmelo notwithstanding, although Carmelo's more of a Ryan Anderson replacement than he is the other two. And so now it kind of feels like a lot of these people are going both ways. But if you would have given them the benefit of the doubt, had they paid what it took to keep Ariza and Bamute, I can respect that. I'm not sure if it would have worked out exactly the same, especially with the freedom of movement stuff, but I think I can respect where you're coming from if you would have given them the benefit of the doubt had they kept that combination together. But as far as Ariza in particular, I know that's a sensitive issue for you. Expand on why you hate when Rockets fans toss that out.
It's just such a – part of it is this bothers me with a lot of teams is somebody finds a stat and it gets retweeted, and then it just gets added to this list of, like, talking points. Mm. And it's just like, well, we were 14-0 without Ariza, so that proves that he's not good. Well, that's stupid. That's a bad way to look at things. Look, you can win games for a lot of reasons. You can win, like, the 14-0. I'd have to go back and look at, contextually, what did that makeup look like? How many times were they playing specific opponents? How many times were they playing opponents that were missing key personnel? How many times did that come down to, oh, well, a lot of weird things happened in that game or this other thing? And that's not to say that it doesn't work, because obviously it worked like it did. The other thing is that a player like Ariza, his effect on the team is cumulative. It's not an individual game. Like, you don't bring in Trevor Ariza. There are players that you bring in because you're like, he can win me a playoff game, or he can win me a game that's going to go either way. To be honest with you, that's a lot of what they did this summer. I really think, talking to some folks, is that the line of thought expressed to me was to take some shots at a higher upside. So I think part of the thought was, Melo's the kind of guy that if he goes off for 27 in a playoff game, that gets you there. Even if he's not good the rest of the time, or he's good very rarely, if he's good in like five games, like three regular season games and two playoff games, that can swing pivotal games that you need. Michael Carter-Williams, if he's better in Houston than he was the rest of his career outside of his rookie season, you know, he winds up turning it, and you're like, oh, that guy. Versus you are almost never going to be like, wow, Trevor Ariza really pulled that one out for us. We would have been sunk without Trevor Ariza, because Trevor Ariza is never going to shoot that much. But what Ariza does is he creates a cumulative effect, and I think there are very strategic things that have been commented on at a lot of different places. There have been good breakdowns all over the place on the switching problems and how this has caused issues. Mm-hmm. The Athletic has done good stuff on it. SB Nation's done good stuff on it. Like, all of these things are part of why the switching thing is problematic. But it does say a lot that P.J. Tucker, who knows the most about defense of any player on that team, says, well, part of our problem is we just don't have the same personnel. Like, that's a pretty up and down, straight out, okay, look, you can look at the suspensions and the injuries and whatever you want for the wins and losses, but the reason the defensive issues aren't there, according to the guy that does the most for them defensively, is they lost two key guys that were great at what they do, at the specific scheme that the Rockets use. And like, and the final thing is just Ariza is a bridge between Harden and Paul. Like, he has his locker room presence is a guy that has been on great teams, that's competed a long time in the league. He's a long time veteran. He's been there. He has relationships with those guys. That stuff matters. And that was part of my thing is, look, it's great that they won without him. But if I told you on the surface, oh, this team went 14-0 without their starting small forward, would you think, oh, that guy clearly has no value? Or would you think, wow, that's probably a pretty random stat, and that's probably not going to happen again? That's why I have an issue with that 15-0 stat.
Sure. And I'm sure some are listening to this and saying, look, Trevor Ariza, and of course, small sample there as well, he started 6 games in Phoenix, and he's averaging below 10 points a game and shooting 33% from the field. But first, it's apples and oranges in terms of, you know, the shots he's getting in Phoenix compared to the shots he's getting in Houston.
Yeah, he's in Phoenix. Like, yeah. I commented on the first night, and that was my mistake. I shouldn't have commented on the first night. I'll take the lump for that. I shouldn't have commented on the first night because I know how bad the Suns are.
Yeah.
But, like, you literally have to pretty much throw out any player's performance because they're playing in Phoenix.
Yeah, and in fairness to P.J. Tucker, I want to clarify, somebody was there, like, he didn't directly say Ariza and Bamute, the Rockets do have some injuries as well, but I don't think it's, you know, a huge leap to assume that's at least part of what he's inferring there. Just want to clarify, he didn't outright say it, but I think that's a reasonable inference.
Who else would, what, you think he's right. talking about Harden?
No. Well, I mean, to James Ennis, a small extent, I think that loss hurts them. But yes, I think at least in part, he's referring to Ariza and Bamute. Yeah, I'm with you on the general theme there. Just wanted to clarify that it wasn't something he directly said. But the interesting thing to me, Matt, is that, you know, you say all these things, and I know there's a segment of Rockets Twitter who, for whatever reason, thinks that, you know, you hate them, that you're so harsh on them. But the irony in this is that, you know, as I see it, from my view, hosting a daily Rockets talk show, you know, they're the ones that are panicking at the moment, and you kind of have this more, I would say, level-headed view to where, you know, not that you're saying everything is, you know, rosy, but you're certainly not sounding alarm bells from what I've seen. So, you know, explain that kind of dichotomy, if you will, that, you know, even though you do have these reservations, at the same time, they're 1-4, they're struggling both ends of the floor, it doesn't seem like your, you know, outlook for them has radically changed relative to when the season started 2 weeks ago.
Like, my concern for them was never, like, they're going to suck. That's absurd. How is a team with James Harden, who I voted for MVP 2 years ago, Chris Paul, who I think is one of, you know, the top five best point guards of all time, Clint Capella, who has just been so phenomenal, Eric Gordon, who's a really underrated role player, how are all those, like, how is a team with that combination under Mike D'Antoni going to go from 65 wins to, like, 40? Like, that's not going to happen. Like, that's unreasonable. They're going to be okay. I think there's going to be a time when they're going to look really dominant, when their offense is going to roll to such a degree, and they're going to win, like, 7 or 8 in a row, and it's going to be like, see, those early days are nothing. And I think part of it for me is a lot about, like, what their ceiling is I think that especially the fact that they're already talking about that we are this early in and they have already reached, yeah, we're going to have to change the defense. That is an alarm bell, because having covered this league a long time, what you want to see is you want to hear, like, look, we can still do this. We just have to improve in how we do it. It's the execution. We just have to get a little bit smarter with our switches. We just have to get guys play a little bit better. When you say we are changing our defensive strategy, which was the key to a lot of what we did last year, when you are this bad at showing defensively so far this season, and not just from a scheme standpoint, but also from a basic execution standpoint, when you're that bad, and you're talking about changing it, that's an alarm bell that indicates there are problems here that have to do with who the roster is. And at some point, like, that just becomes who you are. And that was kind of my concern with Houston. Part of it was, like, they're still going to cook offensively. This is going to be a great offensive team. Mm-hmm. But in order for them to get where they want to go, which is a championship, they're going to have to be really good defensively too. And there were times last year when they were great defensively. But I got to see them be able to – I don't have a lot of faith in them adjusting on the fly with flawed personnel and getting to where they need to go. Because part of it, I did a dive on them this weekend and started looking at all their stuff. One of the things that people miss about Ariza and Mbamute is they're not, you know, they're like, oh, I got a lot of comments. Like, you think they're Kawhi Leonard? I was like, no, it's not about that. The problem is you're replacing them with guys that aren't quite as good, which means you have less coverage for your weak point, which is Harden. Now, I've been like, I've defended Harden in key aspects. I've always said like he's really good in the post. When he's made good defensive plays, I've pulled him and put them on Twitter. Like, there's things that are good about James Harden defensively. However, off ball, it's like even last year when I was looking at some stuff this summer, you just wind up noticing a lot. Like, I would do clip reviews on other players. Like, I did a big thing on Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, how they generate open threes. And I wound up, like, noticing, like, a lot of the time, like, who was the mistake? Oh, it was Harden. Like, it's just, it is an issue. Now, you can cover for that when you've got Mbah Mute and Trevor Ariza. And James Ennis, I think, is going to do some of that. But James Ennis isn't as good. He's just not as good defensively because he doesn't have the knowledge base of those guys who have played longer. And so you have a little bit of a slip there, and I think Melo or MCW are way worse. And so now you're surrounding Harden with more guys who are defensive liabilities, and that just it's points per possession just keep getting ticked up and up and up, little shavings that add up at the end, and that's how you get in trouble defensively.
I think there's a couple of small caveats that we should note. Mike D'Antoni at practice yesterday, he did walk back the comments a little bit about the switching. They're trying to change some things, but more about the execution than radically changing the style. Still, I agree with you that for him to even go there suggests a certain degree of alarm in terms of the personnel. Also, it should be noted that the last couple of games, I mean, they went into the season trying Carmelo just at the 4 and 5. That was all they wanted to do, and now they're playing him at the 3. That front line of Carmelo, Tucker, and Capella, I can guarantee you the Rockets knew during training camp they did not want to do that. Right now they're doing it because they don't really have a choice, and offensively they're so limited that anything they get from Carmelo on that end is a bonus. But not saying that would radically change their defensive metrics. I just think that in the short term that's a little bit of a headwind that's not going to be there in the long run. But generally speaking, I think you're right. Another thing that I wanted to ask you about with this whole defense thing is the freedom of movement emphasis and whether that's having a disproportionate impact around the league on teams that switch a lot, which the Rockets are at the top of the list. Because, Matt, one of the things that I've wondered a lot this year is that even if you had kept Ariza and Mbah Mute, and even if somehow you had convinced Jeff Bezdelic to stay, would they have been as effective if this emphasis, and maybe the emphasis gets dialed back throughout the year, I don't know, but do you buy the idea that emphasis from the league, and I know you're someone that watches all 30 teams, is disproportionately impacting them? And if so, are there adjustments they can make, or is it just a matter of hoping that the emphasis, you know, slows down?
I think we're still trying to figure it out, right? Like, we're still trying to figure out what the impact is. It's definitely impacted the scoring. And you look at some of the teams that have struggled defensively, like OKC's been a mess defensively, right? Like, they've been just as bad as anybody has on the defensive end, which is shocking to them. Well, they're leading the league in opponent free throw rate. Houston is fifth, right? However, the Golden State Warriors are fourth, and their defense is still pretty good. The Clippers are second, and their defense is still pretty good. And I think that impacts some of what you can do, but a lot of that is just like contain. It's just about being able to contain. Now, last year, the Rockets had the sixth lowest free throw rate. So there's definitely been an uptick this year. But so this is where it gets really tricky. This is why the freedom of movement stuff is problematic. Well, there's freedom of movement, and that's why they're fouling more, and that's causing the defense to suffer. Okay. Part of being a really good defender is being able to not foul. Mm-hmm. That's part of being a really good defender is not committing fouls. And two guys that could really help you in terms of knowing how to defend without fouling are Trevor Ariza and Luka Mamute. So it becomes a chicken and the egg thing where you're like, well, the free throw rate's up and that's hurting their defense. And my response is they have guys that don't know how to defend without fouling because they lost two guys that did know how to defend without fouling. And that's part of the problem. And the answer is probably both. And everybody's kind of figuring it out. And what's going to happen next month, and I would not be shocked. I would actually put, like, if I was able to take over-under for wins in a month, I would probably take the Rockets over for November. Because what's going to happen is November's going to roll around. They're going to start chilling out with the freedom of movement calls. That's going to go down. Teams are going to start getting tired. Scoring's going to depreciate. And things will probably right themselves a little bit while Houston's offense should return to where it should, because, like, you look at it, it's still good. And then on top of that, like, they're shooting well this year, which they actually didn't shoot that well last year. Like, you look at their up and down, their three-point mark's really good. So there's a lot of signs that they're going to get better. So I would imagine in November, things probably right themselves.
Yep.
I just also wouldn't think that the freedom of movement thing, it's not going to be a long-term issue. And the other thing you have to consider there is, look, yes, the freedom of movement is going to cause problems with the switch, but I actually would probably tell you it's going to cause that switching teams would have fewer problems with freedom of movement. And here's why. If you go back and you watch and you really break down how Houston, one of the things that Houston and Boston did do exceptionally well is switch off ball. They're able to call out stuff. So when the guy comes around a pin down screen on the weak side, they're already switching that without ever having to make contact, which means the guy chasing whoever it is that's coming off of the screen doesn't have to brush past, doesn't have to hold him, because he can call out and say, hey, we need the switch, or they know, they just know instinctively, oh, I'm switching here. And that way you don't have to try and maintain contact. Teams that try and chase guys over screens are much more likely to get bumped on those calls than a team that's just able to be like, oh, just switch, it's fine. So there are, I think, ups and downs on both sides. And then finally, the other thing is, there's not a team in this league that hasn't complained about it. There's not a team in this league that doesn't think that these calls are out of control. And there's not a team in this league that doesn't think, like, we're still trying to adjust. Like, LeBron's talked about it. The Nuggets have talked about it. The Clippers have talked about it. Like, every night I'm hearing another team say, we just have to adjust. And it's going to take them a little bit of time. It doesn't hurt the Rockets any more than it hurts everybody else.
Quick follow-up on that. Do you think that it hurts James Ennis anymore? And I ask you, as someone, I know you followed him his two stints in Memphis, because James Ennis, from a 30,000-foot view, that to me is the guy, and it's an incredibly small sample, that I'm more worried about relative to my expectations going into the year. You know, if you ask me, you know, Ben, going into November, what's different about, you know, how you feel about the Rockets compared to, say, a month ago, the one guy that I have a slightly different perception on is James Ennis. And in part, Matt, the reason is, you know, I'm not going to act like I did a ton of film study on him through his first years in the NBA as he bounced around Memphis, Miami, Detroit, etc. My instinct, besides, you know, reading the analysis pieces over the summer, I talked to a lot of people around the Rockets all summer long who were very comfortable with him, thought he would be able to give you very comparable production, maybe a slight drop off, but not much relative to Trevor Ariza. And again, it's a small sample size. He only played 2.5 games before leaving with the hamstring strain. But even before the hamstring strain, and this goes back into the preseason where generally the team played fine, he was a fouling machine. And so I don't know if that's in his history, if it's the freedom of movement emphasis, but from a 30,000-foot view, it's not so much a question of Carmelo Anthony replacing Trevor Ariza, it's a question of James Ennis replacing, is he capable of doing that at least 75% of what Ariza did a year ago? And so, you know, some of these things, as far as the fouling difficulties, I'm just curious if that surprises you as someone that's watched him more over his career than I have.
No. There's a couple things that make a great defender. The core element is effort. That just is a starting point. Steph Curry is a small, relative to other NBA players, weak, though he's like stronger than I'll ever be. Small, weak, pretty slow-footed laterally, unphysical defender. Like, he should be eaten alive.
Mm-hmm.
Steph Curry's a fine defender because Steph Curry tries his ass off. Steph Curry's able to try his ass off because he has such a small offensive load because he has three Hall of Famers. Four Hall of Famers around him at all times. But the effort is still always there. Like, he gives a lot of effort on every single defensive play. The second thing is physical ability. Ennis has that in droves. Ennis is a physical guy. He can body you. He can muscle you. He can stay with you. He's quick. He's able to cut off the baseline. He has good reaction time, all of those things. The third thing is, do you have a wide knowledge base of what it takes to be a good defender? And that usually takes years. It takes big men, in my experience, typically until they're 26 to 27, to have the knowledge base necessary to be a good defender at the center position in the NBA. And Ennis has a good knowledge base, but not a great one. Trevor Ariza and Luka Bamute have an excellent one. And that's one of the gaps there. Now, should be noted, just to use some stats here, and these are not adjusted because I don't like using adjusted, because often those adjusted metrics don't tell you how they're adjusted. So I tend to go with the raw from NBA.com. Like, when Ennis is on the floor, they have a defensive rating of 106.5 in his 70 minutes. So, again, we know the sample size problems here, but 106.5. That's the lowest on the team. When he's off, the number jumps to 115.9. A number that is close to 115.9 is Carmelo Anthony's on-court defensive rating, which is 116.1. Melo's off-court rating is 105. So they are 9.4 points better defensively when Ennis has been on court, and they are 10.8 points worse defensively when Melo's been on court. So I think, like, Ennis is definitely, I think, struggling with the fouling. Like, it's not surprising to me because he's so physical. Torrey Craig is a little bit like this and is a similar kind of guy that kind of came out of nowhere and had to work his way in last year. He's a forward for the Nuggets. He's super physical. He gives great effort. He's really athletic. But there are times when he doesn't know enough about how to play off and he gets caught in players' tendencies because he just doesn't have the knowledge base. Ennis is way ahead of Craig in that regard because he's been in the league longer. It's just that he's really far behind Trevor Ariza and Luke Bamute.
Last question for you, Matt. As far as the Rockets getting to where they want to be, you know, you hit on a lot of the themes, you know, lower floor this year but higher ceiling. That's part of the rationale for Carmelo. And look, the ceiling of the team is still extraordinarily high. James Harden, Chris Paul, they're going to get going once they're healthy and not suspended. Clint Capella, it's been a somewhat slow start to the year for him, but he had some injuries in the preseason. I think that's put him a little bit behind the curve physically with his conditioning a little bit. That should get going. Assuming those play up to par, you know, you're right. This is not going to be a repeat of the 41-41 team from 3 years ago. This is just a much more talented group overall. But you had an interesting tweet the other day about Houston and Jimmy Butler potentially needing each other. It sounds like it's your contention that, look, you know, while this team is going to get going offensively, they're too talented not to. At the same time, for them to actually make another run at the Warriors, is it a fair assessment in your mind to say they need a move of that magnitude, that this group, you know, you would never count them out because clearly there's a lot of upside offensively, but it sounds like that to actually push Golden State again, they probably need a move of Jimmy Butler magnitude. Is that reasonable? Just curious what you meant by, you know, Houston and Butler needing each other.
Yeah, man, from the sense of it's been a bad start and there's a lot of issues that you can point out and there's a lot of randomness in that sample, which Rockets fans want to mention. I get that. The concern, I think, even though I think that they will be fine, the concern, I think, is you don't want it to spiral.
Mm-hmm.
The hashtag Rockets culture talk, that's where a little bit of this comes in, which is, I don't know that this team is going to have the internal fortitude to withstand the tough times if things get real bad. Like, if they lose a few more, and you're getting, like, if you start creeping up on, you're like 6 games under .500 at 4-10 or something, that's when you're in real trouble. Then it's like, all right, this is a disaster, because now you're 14 games into your sample. You don't want it to spiral. I don't think it will. I'm just saying you don't want to. And right. Jimmy Butler would definitely, I think, prevent that, because it would just be like, okay, Butler does all of the stuff that I talked about earlier about compensating for Harden. You no longer have – you are able to put at all times with James Harden four defenders who can capably cover for him. It makes Melo completely – like, you just don't need him anymore. You just – it doesn't – like, then he's in a Ryan Anderson role. Like, you just said, like, well, he's in kind of the Ryan Anderson role. I'm like, he's playing 30 minutes a game. That's right. Not last year's Ryan Anderson role.
Right.
I get that that's the injuries. I get that, but it's still – so far, we've seen Melo playing quite a bit. But then, like, Melo, you just don't need him anymore. And that's where you want Melo. Is you want Melo in a position where if, like, when Ryan Anderson was called upon in 2017, when guys got hurt and had to play center or had to play power forward and he had to play, you want a guy that could step in that role and do something. Like, if Melo's in that spot where it's like, you don't need him, you don't need him. Like, most of the time, you're good. But if a situation arises where you need him, Carmelo Anthony's going to come in, he's going to hit three threes, he's going to turn the game around, he's going to point to his head. That's where you want him. And Jimmy Butler, I think, enables him to be in that kind of a position. With Butler, I think, you know, him needing them is like, he needs to be on a team where that has a kind of obsessive drive to win that he does. And while, like, I think Harden wants to be great, and I think Paul wants to rip their heart out. And Capella wants to win. And Mike D'Antoni wants to win. Like, the Rockets are an organization that is about winning. And that's such a cliche-ass thing to say, but there are organizations that are not. There are organizations that have not done the self-evaluation to consider them as such, but the Rockets have. The Rockets are committed to winning, and they're winning now. And this is a shot for Butler to be a star on a team with a lot of other stars and to compete. If he says he wants to be on a team that wins, this is as good an opportunity as any for him to try and make a run at that, and that's why I think they need each other.
Good take. Folks, that's Matt Moore. Follow him on Twitter at HP Basketball and read his insight at The Action Network, www.actionnetwork.com. That's where he is the senior NBA writer. Matt, thanks so much for the time, bud.
Thanks so much, man.
Good stuff there from Matt Moore. And with that interview complete, I'll now get ready for tonight's game, because hopefully the Rockets, as he mentioned, you don't want it to spiral, and being 2-4 would feel a heck of a lot better than 1-5. We'll recap whatever happens on tomorrow's show. Hopefully the Rockets still without James Harden, still no James Ennis, but against a Portland team on night 2 of a road back-to-back, it should be an opportunity, especially since the Rockets haven't played since last Friday and should be fresh to get back on the winning track. Knock on wood. But again, whatever happens, we'll break it all down tomorrow in our recap show on Wednesday. For now, this is where we'll leave you on Tuesday. As always, thank you all so much for listening. If you want more content before the next show, and that includes analysis of tonight's game before the recap podcast, the best place to get it is on Twitter. I mentioned Matt is on there at HP Basketball. I'm on there at Ben Dubose, and this show, Locked On Rockets, is on there at Locked On Rockets. But yeah, on Twitter, other avenues that you can access our content or ask me questions about the team, suggestions for the show, advertising inquiries, all sorts of things like that, LockedOnRockets.com, Facebook.com/LockedOnRockets, email at LockedOnRockets@gmail.com. Again, all of those are ways that you can get in touch with me. Also, as mentioned earlier in the show, Locked On Texans is our sister show here in Houston, the Locked On Podcast Network. You can find us iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, TuneIn, Megaphone, et cetera, because we've got a great network of shows across the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, and college sports, local experts across so many of those major markets here in Houston. That includes the Houston Texans, who have won 5 games in a row, and today made a big deadline deal, NFL's deadline day, trading for star 5-time Pro Bowl wide receiver Demaryius Thomas of the Denver Broncos. So if you want to listen to that show, again, you can find those and subscribe to them at the same places you can listen and subscribe to Locked On Rockets and listen to Robert Land and Brian Patterson's recap on Locked On Texans. I know that's coming tonight. And again, if you subscribe at those platforms, and not just subscribe, that's how you get episodes right when they come out, but also leave us a 5-star review. That's how we can look attractive to potential advertisers and keep the business model working here at Locked On Rockets and Locked On Texans, the most regular podcast covering these professional teams in Houston. With those plugs out of the way, this will do it. Again, thanks to Matt Moore for joining us. Thanks to you for listening. And please come back tomorrow when we'll be breaking down tonight's game between the Rockets and the Blazers from Toyota Center.